in particular to Lava Rosenzweig for gracing us this evening off a brief email exchange. I think you spoke to Mugger Novot a few years back, and in the meanwhile you have become even more of a teacher of mine, so Murray Varabi. It's fantastic that you're here. Thank you very much. And thank you for everyone for coming on a cold Wednesday evening. Most importantly, please do help yourself to food and drink, also hot drinks if anyone would like. And if I may hand over to you, and then maybe some time for questions.
Sure. How long should I plan for in general? Like, how long? An hour for the whole thing?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay.
That's okay. For
a whole thing.
You've got to haggle.
Yeah. No, like with the questions, with everything, I should assume an hour. That's fine. Okay. So first of all, thank you to Pat. Thank you for the hospitality here. I really do appreciate it. I came in to the UK not so much to give talks, but to have a few meetings in anticipation of hopefully doing things regarding mental health and the Jewish community here in the UK. That's the goal of my trip. But on the side, you know, since I was asked here in order to speak, so I'm very happy to do so. So, you know, thank you very much for inviting me, and I really do appreciate it. So here's what I'll do. I guess I will, since the topic is, like I said, somewhat vague, I will give you a brief introduction about what I do, meaning what is mental health and halacha, what does Yoni Rosenzweig do with his time, how I got into this a little bit, really a brief kind of like biographical note, if you will, and then we'll go straight into the topics themselves, with leaving, of course, time for questions. I will also try to emphasize why I think this topic is of extreme importance, which I think everybody feels on some instinctive level, but to really understand like what the significance of it is. A little bit about me. I'm 44 years old. Married to Ilana, my wife, five children, Baruch Hashem. We live in Beit Shemesh. I did 8 years in yeshiva in Malat Adumim, not the Gush, even though, you know, people say, oh, the Gush. No. And then in 2006, I went on Shlichut. I was 3 years in Melbourne, Australia. I was Rosh Kol over there. I came back in 2009. And as many shlichim do when they come back, I was unemployed for a year. And then after I did the minhag of shlichim, I took on a position as a community rabbi in Beit Shemesh, where I have been for the last 15 years. Beyond that, I've taught in several places, and including but not only online, in certain courses. And ever since 2017, 2018, I've been increasingly involved with mental health and halacha. How did I get into this? People always ask me. It's not such a great story. It's really through shilas that I got asked from community members. The shilas led me to do what any rabbi usually does. If you want that closer, you can have closer. We're good. As any rabbi usually does when they're asked questions that they don't know the answer to, you try to look in the books to see what's around. And here was the first really shocking revelation to me, was that almost nothing has been written on this topic. Questions of mental health, I'm not saying they were never asked or that they were never answered. That's obviously wrong. Okay, and I'm sure that you can ask the elderly rabbis in your community whether they were ever asked, you know, before I was born, you know, questions about mental health. I'm sure the answer is yes. But the issue is not whether they were asked or answered. The question is whether anyone wrote anything down. And most of these questions were word of mouth. Most of the questions that people asked were answered without any significant fundamental halachic work being put forth as a framework to help conceptualize what that would look like or what that would mean. So if you look at tshuvas of the great halachic luminaries of the previous generation, names that we all, you know, speak with awe, such as Moshe Feinstein, Rav Ovadia Yosef, the Tzitz Eliezer, Shevet Alevi, etc., etc., or even current poskim, such as Rav Osher Weiss, you know, and others, you know, who, once again, I have no doubt get asked shilas, that's not the question, but how much literature was actually put out to explain what the psukim would be and why the psukim are as such. That, when I came to the topic, I found there was an extreme lack, a dearth of material on this subject. it can be explained in many ways, and later on, if someone asks, I can explain it. But, you know, it can be explained in many ways why that is. Either way, those were the facts of the matter. So I went to Dr. Harris, Dr. Shmuel Harris, who has an institution, Machon Dvir, in Jerusalem, and I said, we have a Harusa anyway. Let's learn about this. I don't know anything about mental health. I'll say that right now. You know, like, I don't have any degree. I'm not a social worker or psychologist, or not a psychiatrist, you know, of any sort. So I need to understand this. So let's learn together. We sat for 2 years to learn, you know, the topic. I learned about mental health. During that time, I also developed kind of like a halachic framework to discuss mental health. And that idea became an idea for my nonprofit, which I created two, 3 years ago. I mean, we took out a book together. It took 4 years. But we took out a book called Nafshi B'Sheilati. Recently came out in English as well. The book became an idea for a nonprofit. Nonprofit, it's called Magle Nefesh, which basically deals with rabbinic training. That's number one. Number two, we have a helpline. People can basically ask their shilas, you know, through Magle Nefesh. And number three is raising awareness. So I travel a lot to raise awareness. In Israel, I travel a lot as well. But also in communities abroad, I'm invited often to speak in all kinds of places to discuss these issues of halacha and mental health, which I will explain in a moment what those are. Okay, but it's not just, to be clear, it's not just communities. You know, it's communities, it's yeshivas, it's seminaries, it's hospitals. I've been to Soroka Hospital, I've been to Herzog Hospital in Jerusalem. I'm invited to, when I get back, I have after Mayne Yeshua and Merchavim and Nes Tziona. You know, I speak to the psychiatric staff over there about the work that I do. I'm invited to speak to social workers, you know, in their conferences about, you know, different things, and et cetera, et cetera. Meaning there's a lot of need for this sort of work and this sort of understanding. And Baruch Hashem, you know, we've seen great success in the 3 years that we've been around. So that's the long and the short of the technical stuff. What are questions of halacha and mental health? So when I say that, what do I mean? So there are questions about halacha and mental health that I'm sure you can imagine. And there are some that I'm sure you could never imagine. The thing that I've learned about mental health and halacha is that the questions come out of nowhere. Like you really can't imagine some of the questions, where they're going to come from and what they are. But let me give you some of the classics and some of the, shall we say, the more rare kinds of questions. But some of the most classic question that I get is whether a person can use their phone on Shabbat. It's a big one. The phone is a central coping mechanism for anybody with depression, anxiety, OCD, BPD, borderline personality disorder. If ever I say an acronym that you're not familiar with, let me know. I'm happy to explain it. You know, those are classic situations where a person would need their phone, either to call someone, to call a therapist on Shabbos, to call a friend, to call a family member when they need help, when they're having a panic attack or something along those lines, or to watch something, or to listen to music, which is a very common question. Listen to music. By far, the question that I get more than any other question is, can I listen to music on Shabbat on my phone? And I don't expect everybody here to understand why that's necessary. You know, we have to be a little familiar with mental health in general, and perhaps with depression, significantly to understand what that is. But in short, I will say, right, that, you know, people, the distress is here many times. And if a person is suffering here, what they need is to get out of here. They need to not be able, not to be stewing in their thoughts constantly. And what the phone gives is a way out. It basically provides a distraction so that the person is not harming themselves or having harmful thoughts, you know, in their head. That at the end of the day, right, is what we're talking about. So that is by far like one of the most classic questions that I get. By the way, I know a lot of people say, so what did you say? So what did you say to that? So what did you pasken on that question? Yeah. You know, so many people always want to know the answers to the questions. I'm always happy to answer, but I'm going to leave that to the end. It's more important for me many times to share the challenges, but if you have a specific question that you want answered at the end, I'm more than happy to, to answer it, okay? But that's a classic question. Nida, women, you know, who are Nida, who can't touch their husbands, who are suffering from depression, also ask me quite prevalently, you know, like they ask, can I get a hug? Can I get a hug from my husband if I'm having a depressive episode and I'm in Nida? Can he, if he is having a depressive episode, can I give him a hug, right, to help him through it? You know, is that allowed? So that's a question that I get asked quite often. Kibud avim, do I need to respect a parent who is abusive? Who is abusive physically, emotionally, sexually, etc., etc. Physically, of course. What are the laws? What are the obligations, you know, that I have towards such a parent? Once again, a question that I get asked quite often. All good? You want to write something down? Okay. Okay. So that's another example of a common question. Questions of OCD and halacha. I mean, people think know a little bit about OCD. They understand that there are shailas about OCD, but there are plenty more than you think. So people say, oh, washing hands and OCD. Yes, of course, cleanliness and OCD, Pesach and OCD. You know, people use that even colloquially, right? I'm so OCD about Pesach, you know, like people will say. But obviously, someone who is actually dealing with OCD, it's not simple for them. So yes, there's definitely those common questions, but there are questions about OCD that you wouldn't expect. You know, this year when you're in Shul, Purim is coming up, right? So classically, the rabbi will get up and say, "Everyone needs to be silent to make sure that they hear every word." What a terrible thing to say to someone with OCD, right? You have to hear every word. I mean, someone with OCD will sit there and then go to a second Megillah reading and a third Megillah reading. I know people who do this. It's not like, this is not theory. This is, everything I'm telling you are things that I know. Yeah? You know, so someone with OCD does not need to hear, and I'm not saying the rabbi shouldn't make the announcement, you know, but people with OCD need to know, right, that people say to me, how will I know that I heard every word? So I said to them, you heard it. I'm telling you before Purim, you heard it. Yeah, not after. Like, you heard it. Believe me. Sit in the crowd, listen to the Megillah, you heard it. Are you sure? Oh, maybe I missed a word. It's all good. You heard it. Done. You go to one Megillah reading. That's it. Done. Finished. Right? But we don't think about that, right? OCD doesn't connect to Megillah reading for us. Right? That's a question people don't even consider. They don't even think, oh, what's the issue with that? Who even knew that there was such an issue? I know people who thank me every year. You know, they say to me, thank you so much for that psak. You know, I used to go to 3-4 Megillah readings. You know, we have to tell people, we have to recognize the fact that there are people in our communities who can't handle, you know, some of these statements that we make, you know, completely innocently, you know, but that, you know, might very well be very damaging to the person and troubling, right? So Megillah reading is a classic example of that. OCD and kashrus. People have OCD. Many times have kashrus. They, every little thing that happens, you know. In the kitchen, I touched schnitzel 3 hours ago, and now I touched a yogurt, and maybe, and this, and that, you know, etc. Shailas that I get, right? OCD and Nida, you know, in terms of going to mikvah, and did I do it properly, and did I check properly, and did I prepare properly, you know, etc., etc. A lot of doubts that have to do with that. OCD and vowing, right? People who think that every thought that goes through their head is a vow, you know, because of their OCD, definitely have had that. Even OCD and idol worship, Avodah Zarah. You might say, what's that? Yeah. So, yeah, sure. I have people who call me up. There was one woman. You know, she sees crosses everywhere. Like, I can't see one here right now. But, like, imagine if there was, like, a line that goes through it on the window. Yeah, just the way the window is shaped. Yeah. So they would say, oh, that's a cross. You know, they would say, oh, now I'm thinking about Jesus. Now I thought about Jesus. Look, it's all good. Yeah. You know, et cetera. And then they think they've done something terrible and that they've betrayed God. So those are the words that they use. And that, you know, and they call me up crying, like mom is crying. Like they feel like, you know, they've done something terribly, terribly wrong. So yeah, that's a problem, you know, for sure. Eating disorders. are another good example of questions that I get. So if I told you that there were questions of eating disorders and fasting, I don't think you'd be so surprised. I think those are, you know, relatively well known, right? Like the, someone with anorexia need to fast on Yom Kippur, you know, is, I think, already become, to some extent, a classic and, you know, fairly well known, fairly understood to be a shaila that people ask. But it's not, first of all, just anorexia. There's bulimia, there's binge eating disorder, there's ARFID. Like, there are other eating disorders and less talked about, you know, than anorexia, but certainly deserve, you know, also, you know, attention. And certainly I get those shailas for sure. But it's not just fasting. This may be new to you, but there's a lot of food stuff going on in Judaism. Like, maybe you've noticed. Like, we have a lot of stuff around food. Yeah. So, anything, right, that has to do with food. I mean, if someone with an eating disorder comes to Pesach and they have to change their entire diet, how do they do that? If they can't eat kidneyot, right, what are they supposed to eat, right? And they have a specific meal plan that they have to follow. I mean, that's not so simple, right? So either we find a way to do it or we're making on kidneyot or whatever it is, you know, but sure, that's definitely also Pesach. Anything has to do around food, right? People ask me, what if I'm, this might sound like a weird question, but I promise you was asked, yeah? You know, someone's in the eating disorder, like hospitalized for eating disorder, and they're forcing them to eat. Sometimes people don't want to eat, so what they do is they force them. How do they force them? They don't force feed them, like, stuff through their mouth, but they might take away privileges from them if they don't, you know, like, follow through with the eating, with doing what they're supposed to do. They might take away their phone. They might take away, you know, all kinds of other things, you know, until they do what they're supposed to do and eat what they're supposed to eat. So someone said, if I'm being forced to eat, do I need to make a bracha on the food? It's a shayla. Yeah, achila be'onis. There's a seif like that in the Shulchan Aruch about, you know, eating when you don't want to be eating. Sure. Achila be'onis is a question. I got the opposite question from bulimia. So if I ate and then I went to the bathroom and I threw everything up, do I have to make a bracha achrona, like afterwards? Right? It's actually a shayla. It's a good question. You know, like, sure, 100%. Now, you might say, well, you know, like, these people are really bothered by that. They're like, they have an eating disorder. Like, yeah. Religious people have a religious identity. And if you didn't believe that before I said it, you certainly believe that after you heard that the Chatufa, Agam Berger, when she was in captivity, she wouldn't eat treif meat. Yeah. Which is like, if the Rishayim over there, the Hamas, if they had let her, given her a phone, asked a rabbi, any rabbi would have told her she could eat whatever she needed to eat. But for a person, right, their identity as a Jewish religious person is important to them. So much so, sometimes they're willing to die for it. Yes. So much so that they will hang on to it even under impossible odds. It's easy to tell someone, right, that in pikuach nefesh situation, oh, you could do whatever you need to do in order to save your own life. But for the person themselves to do it, right, when that's part of who they are and what they believe in, that's not as simple. And if everything else is taken away from you, your basic freedoms are taken away from you, sometimes you hang on to the only thing you can hang on to, which is your belief system, and that makes you who you are and what you are, right? So halachically, right, and not that I'm trying to criticize her, halachically, of course she was wrong. Yeah, she could have definitely eaten that food, but do I understand it? Of course. My grandfather was in the Holocaust, and it was in Auschwitz. As if I don't know, you know, stories from Auschwitz and the things that people did over there, even of course they didn't have to do those things, you know, but when you're in a situation, right, so obviously it's not about the halacha, it's about your identity and about who you are and what you feel you represent and what it represents to you, you know, in that situation. But my point is, you know, from all that, is that, you know, yes, people ask shailas about these things. You might not believe that they ask shailas about these things, but they do. It matters to them. Their religiosity matters to them. Their spiritual connection matters to them. So therefore, they do ask questions of this sort, and we need to find answers for them. Now, hopefully you believe me now that I'm busy. You know what I'm saying? Like that I have what to do, and that people ask me shailas. You know, and it's definitely, there's a lot to say on these issues, right? Not the answers themselves, what's the spirit of the answer that needs to be given? So, here is the main thing that I want to impart about this. It's all about balance. If there's one thing that I could say about Paskening, because people say to me, Like, what's the big wisdom about paskening? Look at the Shulchan Aruch, you look at the halacha, and you apply. No, nope. It's not as simple as just applying what the halacha says in the books, because of the example I just gave from Hagam Berger, for example. Okay, people have an identity. It's not just about saying, look, what's most important is your health. That's not true for an individual who asks a shaila. What's most important is that they're able to balance their mental health needs with their religious identity and religious needs. If they didn't care about their religiosity, they would do whatever they want to do. They wouldn't be calling me. Someone who picks up the phone to call a rabbi, a stranger, mind you, okay, who doesn't know them, and they talk about something which is usually hidden and not usually talked about, their mental state, right? They're only doing that because they really care. They're only doing that because it matters to them to stay religious, to remain religious, and they want to know how they're supposed to balance their mental needs and their religiosity. And if I don't offer that balance, they're not even going to do what I say. I know that from experience too. In Hebrew, we say, "Kula she'ena tzibur yachol la'amod ba." There are some leniencies that the tzibur cannot withstand, that the people cannot withstand. People say, oh, people want leniencies. No, nope, not from my experience. People are not craving leniencies. People crave good sense, yes. When sometimes people feel like the halacha doesn't make any sense, then they crave good sense and logic. That they do, and sometimes they will be very critical of a halacha that seems illogical to them. But my impression is that people crave leniencies. If you give someone leniency, if I told any one of you, right, that you could eat on Yom Kippur, I think you would be like, but do I really have to? Why? Because Yom Kippur is part of who you are. No one wants to. I've almost never met the person who wants to eat on Yom Kippur. You know, it's a necessity if you have to do it. And many times you have to like haggle with the person, if you know what I'm saying. Like, someone, well, maybe I'll start and then I'll see how I feel and I'll go till chatzot, I'll do the nighttime. You know, you have to like argue with the person to get them to do it. You know, a lot of times people are not searching to like, the less religion, the better. Anyone who's like that, like I said, usually doesn't ask a shaila. The people who are asking shailas are the ones who care, if they care. Then we can't just take away their Shabbos, or take away their kashrus, or take away their tefillah, or take away any of those things. We need to find a way, once again, to balance it. That's what we need to find a way to do. When people ask me that question about the phone, could I tell them to just, okay, so just like go on the phone, put on some music, go on YouTube, go on Spotify, go on whatever you want, put on some music, listen to it, you know? Yeah, I could say that, but I don't say that. What do I say? I say, look, here's what you should do if you can do. Why don't you make a playlist from before Shabbos? Press play from before Shabbos. Have it running. Attach your earphones. And then just put the earphones in whenever you need to, and you can listen to the music. Now, people around this table might say, ah, so that way he doesn't have to press. We get it, right? Sure, I guess there's that technical aspect of the pressing. But for me, that's not the main point. The main point is that there's a huge difference for this person. If they're like this all of Shabbos, or they don't touch the phone. Earphones in, earphones out, they never touch the phone. Huge difference in terms of the feeling of whether you're Mechal Shabbos or not Mechal Shabbos, whether you're still religious or not still religious, whether you're part of the community or not part of the community. The identity aspect of it is much more conserved through that psak. I try to be as, so to speak, as stringent as I can within the leniency. Meaning I try to support the person and give them the mental health need that they need with conserving the nth amount of religiosity that can be done. Otherwise, it becomes very difficult for the person. How do I know this? I know this from Yom Kippur. When I talk to people with anorexia, if an anorexia is active, I tell them not to fast, period. And to be clear, if you've ever heard a psak about not fasting on Yom Kippur, you know that the rabbis many times will say, you should eat with shiurim. Shiurim are small amounts, right? That according to halacha, are better to eat than the full amount. Which you cannot do with anorexia. Because that is anorexia. Eating in small amounts is the whole thing. So if a rabbi tells someone to eat in shiurim with anorexia, they're basically telling him to be anorectic on the fast. That's a bad That's a bad psak. It's not a good psak. You shouldn't give that psak. Yeah. Generally, no, not shiurim. No. What you should do is the person should be eating regularly according to their meal plan. In other words, my point of all that is to say, there's no middle here. There's no balance. I talked about balance. So, you know, where's the balance in that psak? You're right, there is no balance. When it comes to pikuach nefesh, if I'm convinced that there's pikuach nefesh involved, then I have to tell them to go all the way and to just, not to fast. And what happens inevitably? Arguments. I spend hours on the phone, like an hour, sometimes an hour and a half with one person, just to convince them that they're not bad Jews for doing that, that it's not their fault, that they can do this, that Hashem will not judge them negatively, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The psak is 5 minutes, but afterwards, right, because the psak is so extreme, you're not going to fast. It's very hard to accept. But in pikuach nefesh, you have to say what you have to say, fine. But then where's the balance? The balance is in what comes afterwards. Meaning, I have to give a, so to speak, a machshavik balance, a philosophical balance, a theological balance, to the extreme halachic psak that I've given, in order to allow for that person to, it's like a spiritual empathy that you have to give that person, you know, for them to be able to then actualize the ruling, to take that and go with it and run with it. Right? That's what we need to do. But my point of all that is to say once again that we need balance. So is there a chokhmah in paskening on this? Yes, of course. Because with mental health, the stigma is so significant and people blame themselves. Chad mashmait, meaning, for sure, they blame themselves. Okay, they see themselves as guilty for this. Maybe I could have done more. If someone breaks their hand, breaks their leg, they don't blame themselves necessarily. But for this, they do. Yeah, they feel like they failed somehow. They failed themselves. They failed God. They failed Judaism. And that's not true. For the most part, it's not true. And therefore, what we need to do is help them to understand they're not second-class citizens. You know, they're first-class citizens. That's, at the end of the day, you know, what I always say, what I want to get to, right, is like how I assume, I'm not a woman, how I assume women feel when they are driven to the hospital on Shabbos to give birth. I never heard from women saying, oh, but Chil Shabbos was terrible. Like, you know, like, I never heard that. You know, generally it's understood. You're allowed to do that because it's important that you give birth in a hospital under care, you know, et cetera. And people don't hesitate and they go up, they do it, right? If someone collapses in shul, you call it tzela. Maybe they'll wake up in 5 minutes. You don't take that chance, right? You know, like maybe it's not pikuach nefesh. Maybe we don't know. Right now, this person's unconscious. So we're going to do whatever we need to do in order to help that person, even if it's a deoraisa, even if it's a Torah prohibition, we'll do it. Yeah, that's how people react to physical health. But with mental health, we hem and haw and be like, you know, we're not sure, and this and that. Is it really necessary? You know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I'll tell you, it's a bit of a shocking story. I got a call about, I don't know, two months ago, maybe 3 months ago. It was half an hour before Shabbos, Erev Shabbos. I live in Beit Shemesh. A woman called me from Beit Shemesh, and she said to me, my daughter, I haven't heard from her in a day and a half. She lives in Jerusalem. It's half hour before Shabbos. My children have tried to call her. I've tried to call her. I haven't heard from her. And she has a suicidal past. What do I do? I want to go over there. Can I drive over there right now? I said, get in the car and go. You know, don't even hesitate. Get in the car, go. She went. Motzei Shabbos, I call her to find out what happened. And she said to me she was too late. She said she got there and her daughter was already dead. You know, like, but the story was terrible. But I ask myself, right, what would happen if I told that, if the story ended differently? Let's say I told you, right, that she got there and there was some other, you know, run-of-the-mill reason why she wasn't answering her phone, right? You know, like, there was some reason, who knows why. Yeah, she overslept, she this, she that, she was out, she forgot it, it broke. Oh, I don't know, a million and one reasons why, you know, etc. Then maybe people around this table, I'm saying you would, if you'd think like, okay, but she drove on Shabbos, was that really necessary? Like, here's the point, okay? Like, the point is, sure, we're very good after the fact, like, you know, to look back and say, you know, like, you know, hindsight is 20/20 with like that. Well, was that really necessary? We don't ask those questions when it comes to physical health. With mental health, we shouldn't ask those questions either. We have to understand what's at stake, you know, and sometimes we'll be too late. And hopefully some other times we won't be, you know, and we shouldn't take any chances. Mental health is very real. People are suffering greatly and need the help and need the assistance. And we hear some of the sad stories. We never know what if. Like, what if we save someone's life, we'll never know it, right? We'll never know it because we were there, because we did answer the phone on Shabbos, because we did let them use the phone, because they did listen to the music, because they did. And then after the fact, we'll be like, so was that really necessary? Well, you'll just never know, will you? But nevertheless, even though you'll never know, we have to understand it's the same as someone who has passed out in shul. Also there, I'm betting that there are, I don't know, 150 reasons why a person could faint, and most of them are not pikuach nefesh. But you're still worried about the 1% that is, right? So if there's a 1% chance that the cause here is of great significance and might be detrimental to the person's health, you're not going to take the chance. So it's the same thing with mental health. We need to respond in a decisive manner that takes into account the severity of the issue and helps to destigmatize mental health. And here is the last point that I'll make before I open up for questions and comments, okay? Halachicizing mental health is destigmatizing to mental health. It's the thing that I learned when I first started this work, because people were telling me, wow, it's really important what you do. And I said, thanks, but I honestly did not really understand exactly what they meant, because I'm not a mental health professional. To be clear, I give halachic answers to shaylos. I don't give mental health care. You know, they're not better because of me. They're spiritually, halachically, they can handle things. That's true. Yeah, but the feedback that I was getting from individuals like, this is really important work. It's not just another halachic field that someone decided to be an expert in. Like, wow, doing life-saving work. So while I know that that's true today, at the time, I was asking myself, but why is that really so? And the answer, like I said just now, is when you halachicize, you destigmatize. If someone is in bed with a high fever and you tell them they don't have to go to work or they don't have to go to school, but then someone is in bed and says they have depression and you tell them, like, can't you get out of bed? You know, then you missed the point. The message that you've given that person is that your pain and your suffering is transparent. I don't see you. I don't understand you. I don't know what's happening. I don't get it. So when someone has a broken hand or they're bleeding, right, or they have a fever or an infection, that we respond to immediately and decisively and clearly. And the person gets the clear message from us that we are on their side. And also halachically, it's true. If you went to your rabbi and you said, I have a surgery and it's planned for Shabbos, what do I do? Regardless of what the rabbi would say, because I don't know what he would say, because I don't know the details, I know what he would say. The message that you would get from the rabbi is Shabbos is important, your surgery is important, let's find a way to make it work is the best way that we can. Maybe we can postpone the surgery, maybe you need to have it on Shabbos. But you'd never get the message, it's like, sorry, it's Shabbos, you'll just have to lose the arm. You know, like, that would never be the messaging that you would get. I've never heard someone say that they went off the derech because they couldn't reconcile caring for their physical health and Judaism. Never heard that dilemma. You know, it doesn't even begin. Any rabbi that I know would give over to the person asking them that their physical health is important and we must find a solution that will conserve your physical health. We must find it. That's why I'm not afraid to say we have to find a solution for all mental health questions. You're like, oh, so you're like sticking the arrow and then you're, you know, like, what's that got to do with anything? It's not possible for us as a Jewish Orthodox community to not find answers to those questions. Whatever they are, we have to find what they are. In the same way, we have to find an answer for a person who needs a surgery on Shabbos. You know, there must be an answer. How do you know? Maybe there's an answer. Maybe they just have to lose the hand. That's not impossible. That's not possible. It's not possible to say that. There's no way that that's the answer. I know what isn't the answer. I may not know what is the answer, but I know what isn't the answer. There are definite, we have things that we know decisively are correct. With physical health, we've destigmatized physical health to a large extent. I'm not saying completely. There are still areas, you know, that we need to work on. But mental health, when you halachicize, you destigmatize. That's significant in the Orthodox community. When I say to a person, if I stand here and I say, hey, you can use your phone on Shabbos to help with your depression, then people here, if they're surprised at the psak, well, actually, that's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to say, oh, really? Like, you're really taking this seriously. So seriously that you're saying they could even use their phone? And I'll say, yep, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's right. I think they're really suffering. And I think that if they don't use their phone, they might deteriorate further. That's exactly my point. So, yes, I think that when we use the halachic system, right, in this way, and it wasn't my goal from the beginning, it's just kind of like an afterthought in a sense. Afterwards, I realized what I was doing with it, you know? But yes, I think it helps significantly to give over the message in the Orthodox community that mental health is real and that we're taking it seriously and that people are not transparent. Their pain is not transparent. Their distress is on our minds and we need to do what we can to help them. And rabbis have a significant role in that. If rabbis, and that's what we do, rabbinic training in Magen Nefesh, because if we train the rabbis and we tell them to do these things and to give over these messages, then people are more liable to come forwards and share what's going on with them. And they're more liable to get that help that they need as a result of that as well. Meaning they will come forwards, they will share, and people will know that stuff is happening. And then we can help them. But that all of that has to happen together. Anyway, I will stop here to open up for any questions or comments you may have. If you have no questions or comments, don't worry. I'm a rabbi. I can talk a long time. It's not a problem. Yes?
I was just wondering if you'd ever come up against any negative responses to your work from any people who've spoken to you, including other rabbis?
People ask me that often. The answer broadly is no. And the reason is because... I mentioned the book took 4 years to do. Part of those years, I went around to Rabbanim. Yoni Rosenzweig is not a known quantity, yeah, in most communities, right? People don't know me, so that's fine. Yeah, I'm not complaining. I'm just explaining that as a result of that, the book would be almost worthless, really, if it just had my name on it, because it's all very nice to write a book. But you want people to follow the book. You want people to view it as authoritative in order for it to help them. So what did I do? I went to Poskim, whose names are well known, you know, and asked them shilos for the book. I went to 14 different Poskim. It's difficult, you know, to find quality time from Poskim. But I tried to go for the length and breadth of the Orthodox community, meaning from the liberal to the most Haredi, to the extent that I could spend the time and find the people who are willing to talk to me and give me that time. This might come as a shock to you, but in the Jewish world, there's always one rabbi you think is not worth your time. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, everyone loves certain rabbis and dislikes other rabbis, right? So therefore, if I would have only asked one rabbi, I'm sure there would have been a group of a certain, you know, population who would have said, him, you asked him, you know, et cetera. That's okay. You know, like I've learned that no matter which rabbi I went to, there were always people who said, like, he doesn't understand anything about mental health and he's terrible and you shouldn't have asked him and this and this and that. That's fine. So I asked Rav Hershel Schechter from YU and Mordechai Willig. And I asked Rav Asher Weiss, and I asked Rav Yuval Sherlo, and I asked Rav Rema Cohen from Otniel, Rav Baruch Gigi from Har Etzion, and I asked Rav Eliezer Melamed, Prinei Halacha, if you know who that is, you know, Charles for the book, and my Rebbe, Rav Rabinovich Zatzal, before he passed away, Rav Henkin Zatzal, before he passed away, etc. So I went around, you know, to ask as many people, like I said, and some of those names you might respect, some other, that's fine, that's the point. Yeah, the point is that no matter where you come from, there's probably at least one name in there, you know, that you can connect to. And I think that also is the reason why I got very little backlash, because the book holds the name of very significant postkin who have signed off on a lot of what the book represents and holds. So that's why, perhaps. Yep.
religious Judaism concerns itself with the minutiae for very many things.
You don't say.
What's your sense of how prevalent it is in the Jewish community, being an attractive thing because of the concern about the minutiae, that there is more of a prevalence of mental health issues in the Jewish community as opposed to the wider community?
People say that. I've asked mental health professionals if that's true. For example, with OCD, people always think that with OCD. They assume that with OCD there's more of it. The incidence of OCD in the Orthodox community is not more than in the general community. So I'm told. I didn't do the research myself, but research has been done on this. But you're definitely right that once OCD presents in an Orthodox person, it will many times latch on to the halacha, meaning it will present itself in that field. But there isn't. It's not true to say that being Orthodox creates mental health problems.
No,
yeah,
an attractiveness towards Orthodoxy.
It is true that mental health problems will latch on to a person's Orthodoxy when they present, you know, etc. That is true. That we do see, you know, for sure with Orthodox people. So you could say that Orthodoxy or Orthodox lifestyle is fertile ground, you know, for mental health to, like I said, to latch onto and present itself. But I don't know if it grows mental health problems. You know what I'm saying? Like, being Orthodox doesn't create... The only situations where I would say that it creates mental health problems are maybe with, like, trauma. That I do see, like, you know, but that's true probably with any area. In other words, someone who grows up Lutheran or Catholic or whatever it is might also suffer trauma from growing up that way, right? So a person, and I do get this is true. Yeah, people who say, I'm not religious anymore, you know, and I have mental health problems because of my father or my mother, because of the way they raised me, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of religious standards specifically, right? They can't go near a shul. Triggers them to go near a shul because that is associated with the way that they grew up. So religion triggers them, you know, in that sense, yes. Or if a rabbi abuses someone, you know, sexually or otherwise, you know, yeah, they could have an aversion to religion as a whole as a result of that, right? So it could, certainly there are cases where religion can actually create a problem, but that's because of the people involved, not religion on itself, if you get what I'm saying.
I think it probably happens. I mean, I'm a psychologist, but I see that it happens with other religions. Like, I've seen Muslim people who were, like, praying obsessively, just as you've seen Jewish people.
Right.
Expression of OCD, and, like, a non-Jewish client that have been abused by a member of the church, and then, you know, they don't want to go into a church, and that's the same in Judaism.
100%. That's what I'm saying.
I'm interested in the interface between your role as a qualified rabbi versus what you said yourself, which is that you're not a qualified mental health professional.
Sure.
So is your perspective that when people approach you, you entirely have your rabbi hat on and you sort of take what they say as read, you know, to the extent that you know them, but you just sort of assume if a person tells me X and X about their condition, I trust them. To what extent do you temper that with any sort of responsibility yourself to understand the mental health conditions themselves? Obviously, you're not qualified, but you can kind of gain a more objective understanding. Or so, I guess, it's probably a balance. But how do you sort of strike the line between those two sides?
First of all, if I need to, I speak to the mental health professional involved in the case, whatever it may be. You know, if there's a therapist, I speak to them. You know, if I feel that I need to, or if you know, if there isn't one involved, then I involve one. Once again, if I need to. So obviously, you know, I'm careful. And of course, I need to understand a little bit about what's happening and not just to Paskin in a vacuum. With that said, I will point out two things, okay? Generally, do I believe people? Yes. But I have an easier job than mental health professionals. Mm-hmm. Meaning, a person might walk into a psychiatrist's office and tell a story that isn't true to get medication. Right, they might lie, they might change the facts or things along those lines in order to receive care, to, you know, or to receive what we call in Israel bituach lumi, meaning subsidies of, you know, from the government or things along those lines. All that can happen, and people can definitely lie and tell stories and not be truthful. But on some level, it won't happen with me, and there's more on the line on some level. What do I mean by that? First of all, there's no sense in lying to me, right? If a person comes to me and says, you know, tells me that they have depression, and then I give them some leniency, and then they walk out and they'll be like, I tricked them. I don't really have depression. Who did you trick? Yourself? Like, I mean, it's between you and God. if you don't have depression and you're taking a psak that doesn't belong to you, give them to hate, you know, like, good job. I don't even know what that means. Yeah. I'm surely not the one suffering from it. Yeah. You know, if you're lying to the rabbi and then getting some sort of ruling that doesn't apply to you at all, I don't know who you think you tricked. It's not really clear to me. Yeah. So therefore it doesn't even make sense to lie. Okay. That's number one. But chutz mizeh, like I said before, anyone who's coming to ask a shayla, their religiosity is on the line. Like, it's more than just swindling the government or getting some meds, you know what I'm saying? Like, they actually take it seriously. Seriously, like, they don't have, like, an itchy, like, a trigger finger on that. Like, let's grab a leniency for something, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mostly, I don't find that that's true. However, when I do sense, and it's rare, you know, that the person is calling, but they're not really sure why they're calling, and this and this and that, and maybe they don't really need anything, but someone told them to call, you know. So, yeah, I'm obviously more careful with dispensing halachic advice. You know, many times if I'm unclear, I will use an if-then model. Rather than say yes, no, do this, do that, I'll say, look, if it's reached this and this level of severity, then do so and so and so. And a lot of times the answer will be, oh, I don't think it's that bad. Okay, fine. So then maybe it's not, maybe you shouldn't do that then. Yeah, that's what. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And do you ever find that you're becoming part of the problem, that people need to ask you and check with you so much that they can't then, like, be autonomous with their own decisions? And what would you do?
Yep, happened to me several times. Yeah, I mean, not a lot of times, but it has happened, specifically with OCD, like more with OCD or with BPD, with borderline personality disorder. Those things have happened more. Not so much with the other stuff. But yeah, with OCD, I mean, I can explain the whole thing, but those of you, I don't know how many people here are therapists and understand, you know, but with OCD, I try not to give reasons for my rulings, meaning I just give them a yes or a no, black and white, you know, so the OCD doesn't pick at the reasoning. But it has happened that, you know, that as a result of that, people have increased the amount of times that they ask me. And at some point, I realize that they're becoming dependent. So then, you know, at that point, I say to them, look, this is not good for you. You know, this relationship is not good. And, you know, I mean, first of all, I always make sure at the beginning that they're seeing someone. But I always say to them, you should talk to your therapist, you know, et cetera. As for me, you know, you can't ask me a million shaylos a day. I'm going to keep it to like once a day. You can ask me this question and that's it. You know, you can't ask, because they used to ask me the same question like in seven different variations. You know, like there was one woman who asked about Lashon Hara, right? She would say to me, is this Lashon Hara? I was like, no, it's not Lashon Hara. Are you sure it's not Lashon Hara? Yes, I'm positive it's not Lashon Hara. But what if I'm really thinking it all the time and telling it to people? Is it Lashon Hara? Like, it's the same question in different ways, slightly different, and then she would repeat the question. It was terrible, much terrible. I told her, look, this is getting out of hand, and obviously I handled this the wrong way, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you should just, you have to, anyway, and it stopped. It did stop. Like, you know, I mean, it took her a little while to get used to it, but it stopped eventually. So, absolutely. And with BPD also, you know, once again, if you know borderline, then you know borderline. I mean, it's not an easy personality disorder to deal with, that people become very hurt or dependent or this or that, you know, et cetera. I mean, you just have to put boundaries up, you know, make sure that that you're not feeding into whatever it is that they think is going on. Yeah. I try as best as I can not to be part of the problem, is my answer to you. But it doesn't always work. Yeah, in the back, yeah.
Just one question. Would you have to say to people who... leave their religious life because of the trauma that they've gone through, or just because they choose not to anymore? Do you agree with it, or do you try to convince them to stay, but they're, like, I don't know, traumatized?
I speak to a lot of people who are not religious anymore, but used to be religious. There's quite a, I don't know how to count it, but, you know, there's a relatively large population of individuals. You know, in Hebrew we say datlashim, the tila shavar, right? Previously religious, yeah. Datlashim are not chilonim; they're not non-religious people. They're different, right? There's research on that, yeah. That datlashim don't date well with chilonim because it's not the same. Someone who was previously religious carries with them the scars or whatever you want to call it, Yeah, that feeling of being religious and that knowledge of being religious before. And they can't just go out with someone who grew up in a non-religious home. It's a totally different population, right? So a lot of those individuals, and also from Haredi families many times, you know, who grew up in a Haredi family and now are not religious, you know, etc. But they want a connection to religion. They're in contact with me. Once again, in mental health context, specifically. Do I try to convince them to be religious? No, I don't try to convince anyone of anything. But I do understand their desire to have a connection. And their feeling that if their family had treated them differently, or if they had responded to their mental health problems differently, or if their school system had taken them more seriously in terms of all those difficulties, that they would still be religious today, and that they would still have more of a connection, more of an ability. So they're somewhere in the middle there, and they're trying to figure out, you know, how to move forwards, right? So in that situation, what do I do? I mean, I don't try to convince them of anything, but I do try to help them in terms of moving forwards. I will say one thing to you about the kind of like connected to what you asked, right? Sometimes people say to me, you know, why did God do this to me? I don't deserve this. I'm suffering, I'm in distress, it's not fair, you know, v'chole, v'chole. You know, why should I believe in God? You know, a God who tortures me and gives me all this, et cetera, et cetera. I say to people, I mean, I have long conversations with them. It's not like 2 minutes, it's like an hour. But in those conversations, you know, at some point I say to them, look, let's say you don't believe in God. Are you going to wake up tomorrow without OCD, without depression, without ADHD? Without all those, without bipolar, without schizophrenia, like you're still going to have all the problems. You're still going to have all the issues. But you're not going to solve it by stopping to believe. That's not going to solve your mental health problems. It might make you feel like, okay, like, you know, my belief in God is in a sense, like, you know, sitting on me. It's like, you know, weighing me down. I can understand that. But to be clear, you'll still be dealing with all the same issues tomorrow. The real question is, what is God doing in your life, and how can we make it better? So in other words, your belief in God is very specific. It's a very specific kind of belief. Look, it's the popular belief, all right? Everyone believes that everything that God does is for a reason, and that God is always doing good things for us. The result of those two beliefs is very, very distressing to people with mental health problems who are suffering day in and day out over years. They don't see how any of that makes sense. They didn't do anything wrong, and somehow they're paying for mistakes that other people, you know, many times did to them. So how is that for the best? And how is God taking care of me and looking after me? And what do you mean, Gamzula Tova? It's all for the best, all this stuff, you know, etc. Look, those are the popular beliefs that we all learned in school. And it's all good on a theoretical level, but I can tell you that as a rabbi, we're dealing with practical questions. It's not so simple. You have to say everything's for the best. You know, or the famous, God doesn't give anyone something they can't handle. Okay. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, that's a nice thought. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know where anyone saw that. It's not in the Gemara, as far as I know. I don't know any place in the Gemara or in the Midrashim that say that God can't give anyone something that they can't handle. I don't know. A lot of people can't handle stuff. Yeah. And unfortunately, sometimes it ends in suicide, sometimes it ends in other things.
So then what but, you have to say on it?
So what I'm saying, so sorry.
No, what I mean is you said that God doesn't give you stuff that you can't handle, so then why does God give it?
Right, so I'm saying, but my point is, one second, I'm saying those are the popular beliefs that we hear parroted to us all the time. And I'm telling you, knowing the literature, meaning knowing the literature written in the times of the Rambam and the Kuzari, and et cetera, not my ideas. Ideas that are in the classic Jewish philosophy literature, not everybody thinks that. Not everybody holds that way. Those are just the most popular beliefs that are usually, you know, give it over. To someone who is suffering like that, I say to them, the problem is not that God is in your life. The problem is the way God is in your life. You have posited God as the creator of your problems and the judge and jury of your situation. In other words, that he's the one who looked down, saw you, and said, you know what this person deserves? Schizophrenia. Boom. Yeah. If that's what you believe, then of course you're suffering from your belief in God. Of course you don't want to believe in God, and of course there's no place for such a belief in your situation. Yeah, obviously. But you don't have to believe that. God can also be something else. in your life. We don't have time to go into it, but there's like a whole school of thought. Reb Levi Yitzhak of Berdichev, right, the famous Hasidic Rebbe, used to rail against God, used to get angry at God, you know, every Rosh Hashanah. You know, there was a famous story that once he stood in front of the Bima before Kol Nidre, and he was just silent, wouldn't talk. For like 15 minutes, people were like, what's going on? Eventually he opened his mouth and he said, every year, God, every year we daven to you, and you never listen. If you refuse to listen to our prayers, we refuse to say them. And that's it. Yeah? So, you know, like, we're not used to things like that. We're not used to that sort of talk. Yeah, but Reb Zushav Anipoli, another Hasidic Rebbe, said, you can be with God, you can be for God, you can be against God, you just can't be without God. I think that being against God is a way of being with God. Like, why does God always have to be, so to speak, on your side? Why is that the only way that we can envisage Him and therefore be very disappointed when Him being on our side looks like this? So all I'm saying is, for each person it's different. But we need to think what the role of God in our lives is and what He's actually doing. And that's per person. It's not like I can tell you what I would say, because it's per person, whatever they're going through, you know, etc. But the way that we look at God, right, which is very one-dimensional, you know, of course, it's hurtful to some people. Look, I'll say one last thing. You know, I say to people, imagine if your parent was abusive towards you, like very abusive, physically abusive, which I deal with also, yeah? Many times, years later, the person still wants a connection with their parents, right? They want a connection. They have grandchildren. They want to see the grandchildren, this and that. The past is pockmarked. It's not simple. But they still want to have some sort of relationship. And they ask me, what kind of relationship should I have? The parents never, or whatever. The father, let's say it was a father. The father never apologized, never anything. Doesn't even realize that he did something wrong, you know, etc. I say to the person, look, you can have a relationship with your father, but it's not going to be the same as everyone else's relationship. It's not going to be like a normal relationship. And if he expects it to be, then he's got another thing coming. If you're telling me that your father, right, who abused you, expects you to then just like smile and come in and everything's great, you know, et cetera, and he's not even willing to take responsibility for what he did when you were little, right? Yeah, it's not going to happen. It's not realistic for him to expect that. I tell people, your relationship with God is the same way. Look, if you've been, I'm sorry to say it such in such a blunt way, if you've been abused by God, so to speak, right? If you've been hurt by God, if all your life or a lot of your life you've suffered in a way that's also theological in your mind from the Kadosh Baruch Hu, then I don't think he can expect that his relationship with you will be the same as it is with everybody else. And it won't be. You know, I can go around, you know, because I've had a good life. So I can go around saying, Gamzula Tova, when something bad happens to me, then I say, I like sweep it under the rug, you know, and I say, like, you know, Hashem is taking care of me, and I have to believe that this is for the best and for the good, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And some people, even when things are really bad, they can say that. I'm not saying everybody. Some people, even when things are really bad, they say that. Yes, even people with very hard lives sometimes say that. I'm not saying they don't, and it helps them, and it gets them through the day. Sure. But for some people, that's not it. For some people, yeah, who are suffering all the time, you know, and I know people like that, who have, every year, they have two or three suicide attempts, and then, you know, they're suffering from depression or schizophrenia. I spoke to a woman before Yom Kippur who has DID, dissociative identity disorder, which is like multiple personalities, and she was telling me that she has like 20 personalities that, you know, come up at different times, you know, et cetera, and she's trying to hold it all together and this and this and that. I mean, you know, stories that are like, you won't believe, but I mean, can those people believe the same way? Do they have to believe the same way that, you know, like everyone else believes? Can they not have a different relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu that's based on something else, on a different kind of feeling and emotion? I think that we can make room for that. I think that there's room for that. I think it's right for that person. That was a long answer to your question, but that's what I think. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Yeah.